Intriguing music for our bumpers this morning as Ray Graff gives me a thumbs up. At least I think that was the digit. And it is 14 minutes past 9 o'clock.
That woke me up.
Yeah, that's good. That's what we do. We just try to just bouncer it out of your chair, you know, like in a Tigger-like approach, and say we're ready to go today on this 28th day of August. It is Thursday. And it is 14 minutes past 9 o'clock. Good morning, all. I'm Joe Donahue. We have a wonderful panel of really smart people with us today to talk about issues in the news and beyond, and we will get to that in just a moment. I just want to remind you that if you would like to be a part of said discussion, all you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Also, don't forget that on Monday, September 8th, we will be broadcasting from Lake Placid, New York. WAMC On the Road will bring us to Lake Placid, New York. We're not only going to be broadcasting from Lake Placid, but we are partnering with our friends at North Country Public Radio. As you all know, this program goes from 9 to 12. And I know what you're saying. Wow, that's just not enough time. And I feel you. Boy, if we could just go all day. But and I know some days it feels like we're going all day, but no, it's only 3 hours. So what we're doing is for the first hour, 9 to 10, it will be on WAMC Northeast Public Radio. And then at 10 o'clock from 10 to 12, we will be simulcasting, I believe, for the first time ever, we'll be simulcasting this program with our friends at North Country Public Radio. And we will be doing a joint discussion on two issues. We'll be having two separate hours on two separate issues. We will be talking about border issues with Canada and the North Country and how that is going. We will discuss that. And also, we will be doing our second hour on the changing demographics of the Adirondacks and the Adirondack Park. I will be joined by two very incredible hosts of programs at North Country Public Radio, and we'll be doing that together with a great group of guests. If you would like to join us, if you would like to be in the room where it happens, all you have to do is go to wamc.org/WAMC on the road, and you can find out how you can sign up. I think there's a nominal fee for registration. And otherwise, we would love to have you for our foray to the North Country. So I was told you don't need your passport or an enhanced license or anything like that. So I think I'm fine, and we're firing up the station wagon and getting ready to go. So all that on Monday, September 8th. We'd love for you to join us. Okay. Let me go to introducing our terrific panel this morning. Robert Pendicio is here, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Good morning, Robert. How are you?
I am dandy, Joe. Thank you for asking.
Well, it's good to be dandy.
It is dandy. It's fall feels like it's arriving early. My drive up from the hill towns today was brisk, not in terms of time, but in terms of temperature. It was in the 40s in my backyard this morning.
It was brisk, and but it feels right. It just feels what we refer to as like fair time.
This always happens right around Labor Day, and it is always right around Labor Day. It's as if somebody throws a switch and suddenly, oh, it's fall today.
It's like sweater weather, and that's very nice. Judy Patrick is here. Judy is the former vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association, a longtime editor at the Daily Gazette, and a longtime panelist on this program. And Judy knows this. We had our Washington County Fair last week, and then this week is the great Scaticoke Fair. And the Scaticoke Fair is fantastic. And they started last night. And I drove down yesterday. I was looking at all the stuff. And I thought, oh, my God, this is great. Look at this. I got to stop and get it. And then when it took me 2 hours to get home yesterday, which was completely – that's not the fair's fault. The fair doing their thing. I needed to take a right where I didn't to go around. You go around the reservoir, and then you come up 67 and go over. So anyway, I didn't do that, but it was very nice to see. But it gave me a lot of time to see what was going on at the fair. And it looked great. I can't wait to get there and enjoy all of the cool things that are going on. How are you?
I am fine. You know, I love the intro bumper music because I've spent the last week listening to two small boys sing all the songs from K-pop, Demon Hunter.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, wow. Oh, yeah.
They're in my head.
Yeah.
Very poppy.
Have they found the demon?
Oh, you know, well, don't even get me started. Whoa. They love those songs. They belt them out and they're out of tune.
Well, that's good. Excellent. Well, we're glad you survived Grandma Camp and are here with us and all is well. Speaking of a doting grandfather, we welcome Ira Fussfeld to the program, publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman. And are you enjoying the silence, Ira?
It's just remarkable. My house is like a public library after about 6 weeks of fighting and yelling and screaming. And fortunately, I'm not sure my wife would have.
And that was just the adults.
Well, that's what we're fighting about, me not taking more care of the grandchildren. I'm not sure she would agree that I'm a doting grandfather.
But yeah.
Half of that is right. But. Anyway,
I'm looking forward to
I have a fair question, or not as opposed to an unfair question.
Yes.
Fair, why do these fairs, why are they scheduled in quote-unquote competition with the state fair in Syracuse?
Well, I have an answer for that.
Good.
Okay. The answer is, from my knowledge, that this is the way this used to work is all of the county fairs used to operate from Memorial Day until Labor Day. And the agricultural fairs and the other fairs within New York State, the county fairs, would operate between Memorial Day and Labor Day. Then after Labor Day, the New York State Fair would then come in, and because all of the winners of the various competitions of the best cow and the best butter and the best goat and the best ice cream and the best pie would all then and go compete at the state fair. Problem was is that after a while, because the state fair grew so that it was A, difficult to get these marquee acts that they were trying to get to come in and to entertain. Also, people were out. It was more difficult to get people to come in because school had started, and it was difficult to maintain it. So they moved it up, and then it did conflict.
So that's relatively recent.
Last
10 years,
10, 15 years. Yeah.
I mean, they always used to tout the Dutchess County Fair. I think I'm correct about this. Is the largest county fair in the state?
Pish posh.
That's not correct.
Well, no, it depends. It's usually with some sort of disclaimer. Like I think Washington County calls it the largest agricultural fair.
Okay, I gotcha.
You know, and this would be the largest fair with carrots. Yeah. Or I don't know.
Or in Dutchess County.
And Ulster County Fair, which does not make that claim in terms of size, had Chubby Checker this year. So.
Oh, see, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
For Chubby Checker, who's still going at it.
Wow. Well, someone was telling me the Franklin County Fair had Fog Hat and Blue Oyster Cult. And I was like, man, where is
wow.
Nothing says county fair quite like that, Bill. But no, we used to have some big acts at the Washington County Fair. We had Hal Ketchum, and I think we had Winona.
Who was the first one?
Hal Ketchum.
I don't know who that is.
Hal Ketchum. I'm going to give you this because I don't know the reason we know him is because he's from our town.
Oh, I see.
And he went on to be he's deceased now. He was at the what do they call that?
Opera House.
The Grand Ole Opry.
Grand Ole
he
Opry.
Was inducted into the Grand Ole Opry, and he had a great song called Small Town Saturday Night.
Yeah,
which
song.
Was about
I'm surprised Greenwich, I didn't know
New York.
That.
Yeah,
because there's an obit in the Times this week for David Ketchum. You know that name. You really have to go in the weeds to see that.
Yeah.
He was a character actor, perhaps best known for his work on Get Smart.
Oh, I do know. Oh, okay. Yeah. I was thinking in connection with Hal Ketchum, but yeah, no, no, I gotcha. Yeah. Yes, I know exactly who you're talking
yeah.
about.
Yeah,
yeah. Just to make this all the more long, all the more lengthy and painful. Years ago, we were given a book by the people. Our home was built by my wife's grandfather. And then my wife's grandfather hired one of the workers was Kelly's, my wife's dad. Mm. And the person who originally bought and had the house built had this book chronicling the building of the house. And they had passed but had gone down and somebody gave it to us. And we were going through the book of them building the house, and there on the top of the roof, right by the chimney, putting on the roof, Hal Ketchum.
Wow.
Yeah, Hal Ketchum working with my grandfather, or Kelly's grandfather.
You don't get this information on other stations.
No, you do not.
No, you do not. And there, and research shows there's a reason for that.
Well, in case you asked, I'm doing fine. Nice to be back.
Yeah, it's good to have you back. We miss you. We love you. We want you here all the time.
Thank you very much.
So it's great to have Ira here. And we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Okay, we are done with the announcements, and now we actually have time for a show. We have a lot to get to. I would say a somewhat confusing story. I don't know how confusing it is, but it was while we were trying to put together the stories last night. So it was announced Susan Monterez was said to have refused to adopt Health Secretary Robert Kennedy's stance on vaccination policy. And so then they fired her. The White House says that the new CDC director is fired. However, she refuses to leave. And there was some question from, I would say, maybe around 6 to about 9 p.m. as to whether it was a resignation or a firing or both. And so the White House said late Wednesday that it had fired Susan Monterez, the new director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, after a tense confrontation in which Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. tried to remove her from her position. A lawyer for Dr. Monterez said in response that she was refusing to step down. Dr. Monterez, an infectious disease researcher, was sworn in just 1 month ago by Mr. Kennedy, but had clashed with the secretary over vaccine policy. People familiar with the events said 4 other high-profile CDC officials quit en masse, apparently in frustration over that vaccine policy and Mr. Kennedy's leadership. Because Dr. Monterez has been confirmed by the Senate, previous CDC directors were not subject to such confirmation. She serves at the pleasure of the president, and Mr. Kennedy likely did not have the authority to dismiss her. At 9:30 p.m., a spokesman for President Trump said in an email that Dr. Monterez was, quote, not aligned with the president's agenda of making America healthy again. And so the White House has terminated Monterez from her position with the CDC. And again, that was at about 9:30 last night. Shortly past midnight, one of Dr. Monterez's lawyers rejected the firing as legally deficient because the president did not announce it. The spokesman did not respond to an email message asking if Mr. Trump would do so. The wild back and forth over the future of Dr. Monterez's future, along with the resignations of 4 of the CDC's top leaders, will undoubtedly throw the nation's public health agency into further turmoil. It has already faced a tumultuous month in which agency employees were laid off and a gunman fired a barrage of bullets at its Atlanta headquarters, killing a policeman and terrifying employees. Her lawyers, Abby Lowell, one of those lawyers, had asserted in a statement earlier Wednesday that Dr. Monterez's situation was symbolic of, quote, and this may be the understatement of the year, larger issues. So we begin to try to parse this and figure it out. Who would like to start?
Well, I just answer you. I think your initial characterization of it being confusing is not at all off the mark. I starting with what happened in the last month since she was confirmed and put in the position that Harry is a month later and she's being fired. What did weren't the differences between her point of view and Kennedy's point of view well known by then, at least to each other?
Yeah, it is. I think you raise a great point that I don't know. I'm not in on this situation, obviously. It just instinct and common sense would tell me, would think that at some point, if you're taking the top job of the Centers for Disease Control and you're being hired for the position, that at some point you would be asked about how you feel about vaccination policy.
It's particularly in light of Kennedy's history on this.
Exactly. Yes.
I don't get it.
You said, Joe, that it's been a tumultuous month at the CDC. No, it's been a tumultuous several years.
Yeah, it really
has. And it's a problem, right? In other words, there's an issue with the politicization of public health, and you know, both parties own this. But it is just not okay to have, look, we have a crisis of trust in institutions at large. That is not news. When it reflects or is turned on public health, that's a problem, right? And this goes back to COVID. I actually brought data on this because, you know, I hate not knowing what I'm talking about on the roundtable. But pre-COVID,
I know. You're the
data.
One.
You're the
guy.
All right.
So before
go
COVID,
show off.
The overall trust, and I'm not sure whose poll this was. Forgive me, I didn't write it down. But there was a poll. Overall trust in the CDC pre-COVID, 82%. Now it's 60%. And, you know, from where I sit, you know, doing education policy work, you know, the thing that we always talk about is how the CDC allowed the teachers union to functionally write the guidance about when it was safe to return to school. So that's why, you know, parts of three school years were disrupted. But, you know, there's a price for the politicization, you know, whether it was under Biden, whether it's under Trump now. It's just not healthy, no pun intended, for us to have this level of distrust aimed at what should be an institution, the CDC, that should be above this.
Okay, I hear you. I will ask the question, though. It does seem under this particular leadership of RFK Jr., and given the concern by those, even as he was confirmed narrowly, that he goes in and great skepticism among those within the agencies that he's overseeing, does indeed seem to be a recipe for disaster.
Oh, I'm not disagreeing with that at all. But I'm merely saying that the chaos didn't start this month, or not the chaos, but the lack of trust, the treating public health as a political football is now a well established pattern over years, not just the last month.
Judy Bescher.
The chaos started in this administration. And let's be clear that Kennedy, before to get confirmed, promised Cassidy the doctor slash senator from, was it Mississippi or Arkansas or Louisiana, someone of the southern states, that, you know, he wasn't an anti-vaccine person, that he would support vaccine distribution. This comes as yesterday the CDC announced new regulations or new protocols in terms of who's able to get a COVID shot in the coming season. And what they've effectively done is say people over 65 or people with medical needs can get the shot. Other people can get it perhaps as long as they pay up front. But the CDC guidance is what is used by health insurance companies to determine what they will cover and what they will not. I think that may have been the straw that broke the camel's back on this one. I mean, under Kennedy's leadership, we have not made America healthy again. You know, they instead, what what this administration has done is take, you know, healthy food away from Americans by, you know, cutting, you know, food stamp programs. They've increased, you know, they've cut dramatically funding for medical research. We like to talk about, you know, big pharma and the, you know, the medical establishment that is, you know, just functioning in terms of making money. But when we see a wholesale departure of top leadership at CDC, that's chaos. I know, Ira, you and I have talked about the overuse of the word chaos. Well, I think it reminded me of during the Nixon administration when the Justice Department, when they went through a couple of people at the Justice Department who refused to, you know, bend to Nixon's will when it came to Watergate. So I think this is a real problem. I think, public health advances have been one of the things that our world has benefited so much from in the last generation. I mean, we've had great advances in terms of health or heart disease, cancer disease, vaccinating children around the world, improving public health in so many ways. And I think the CDC has been at the forefront. I'm not interested in re-litigating the COVID coverage. What I want to talk about is what's going to happen to the CDC going forward. And now with the absence of these people, what will happen? Robert Kennedy is going to put his own lackeys in, and, you know, we're all in charge of our own health insurance going forward, our health coverage.
I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, you know, it's nice to say, let's not relitigate COVID, and I'm not interested in it either, except that is really the source of so much of the skepticism and distrust of public health. By the way, one interesting data point that I was very surprised by in doing my homework this morning, vis-a-vis vaccinations, and let me be clear, I am not carrying any water for Robert F. Kennedy's dim view of vaccinations, which I do not share. But trust in vaccinations was a problem even before COVID. 66% of people said they had high trust in vaccines pre-COVID, and it's 61% now. So for whatever reason, there has been a chronic issue with Americans distrusting vaccines.
So I want to get to the Senator Bill Cassidy part of this story. So Monterez, as we said, declined to immediately resign and then enlisted Senator Cassidy from Louisiana, a Republican, chairman of the Senate's Health Committee, who cast a pivotal vote for Kennedy's confirmation after securing commitments to protect vaccines, according to three people with knowledge of those conversations. Cassidy privately pushed back on Kennedy's demands, furthering angering Kennedy, who lambasted Monterez for involving the senator in the first place. Administration officials told Monterez she could either resign or be fired. The officials and other people familiar with efforts to oust Monterez spoke on the condition of anonymity. HHS said she is no longer the CDC director in a post on X on Wednesday evening. We thank her for her dedicated service to the American people, at Secretary Kennedy, and full confidence in his team at CDC.gov, who will continue to be vigilant in protecting Americans against infectious diseases at home and abroad, according to the agency.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong. There was certainly controversy during the pandemic about the vaccine. As I recall, the biggest controversy was the mandatory nature of it. You had to get one, and then masks, which was sort of a sidebar. But on the other hand,
and vaccinations for children.
On the other hand, I I'm certainly not swearing that I'm 100% right on this. The vaccine was terribly effective. People got vaccinated, and the pandemic lessened until we no longer have to wear masks and et cetera. It's this the success of the vaccine, if you agree with that premise, is largely because the first Trump administration hustled the vaccine along. The vaccine became available much sooner than typically happens with vaccines. And so you have a real whether or not you want to give Trump credit for it, it's certainly something that he can try to take credit for, and he's not shy about taking credit. So here he got this vaccine going. The vaccine was put into use. The pandemic petered out. And you would think that this is something he would be championing. Mm-hmm. And instead, and this is, comes back to the your use of the word confusing, why did he pick Bobby Kennedy to begin with, who we know is not a vaccine favorite? And why would he go along with firing this woman who is you could argue, has the same view of vaccines as he, Trump, has? I don't get it. Where in that analysis did I miss up?
I don't think you did. I will say that, you know, I mentioned this and we talked around it, but this does come, you know, along with this, and we use that word chaos. So there have been the budget cuts. There have been the termination of hundreds of employees within the department. There's been an attack on the headquarters, as we mentioned. And then after there are the efforts to oust Monterez, three top CDC officials announced their resignations, and they cite lost funding, the political climate, and a broader attack on public health. So how do you then fix that?
Yeah. Wow. By the way, I don't think it was just the vaccines that have created this climate of skepticism. And again, Judy, I'm sorry, I know you don't want to talk about COVID, but there's a lingering effect here. You know, when you recall some of the things that we knew, and I'm making air quotes when I say the word knew, that it turns out we didn't know. You know, the Wuhan virus, like, oh, no, it was naturally occurring. It came from bats in a wet market. It didn't come from that virology lab that happened to be next door. Well, now we know that that's simply not true. It was during the summer of George Floyd, when we couldn't, you know, go to church. We couldn't see our relatives. We couldn't gather in our backyards with more than 10 people, but we could go to a Black Lives Matter rally because that was a public health issue. You know, the American people were not wrong to view some of this as temporizing, you know, as you know, less than fully thought out. So, you know, again, it troubles me deeply that our public health infrastructure or institutions are under a cloud, but it's not an accident.
But, okay, I understand the point. However, to Ira's point as well, of a vaccine that seemed to be working and got us through the worst. And to say that COVID is over is certainly wrong. We know many, I think probably yeah. Everyone in this room knows somebody who has it right
the
now.
The rates are up right now. Right.
And increase spikes in it right now. But so you go into it coming out of COVID, and then you name as your department head someone who called it the deadliest vaccine ever.
Joe, do not push me into a defense of Robert F. Kennedy.
But I don't know how you not. I mean, I understand. I don't know how you not make that the story,
okay,
though. When you call it poison,
yeah,
and you say that we're poisoning people, and then you say we are going to change who gets it and who doesn't get it, and then the head of the department says,
yeah,
I didn't sign up for that, and right, heads for the door. I seem that seems to be a very contained storm to me.
When I'm president, which, you know, please God, may that never happen.
we like you too much for you to be president.
You're very kind. I wouldn't wish that on anybody. My first priority is to restore public confidence in institutions and among them public health. So is this the way I would go about it? Of course not. If that's because it's clearly not a goal. It's the politicization of everything. This is you know, you were asking why did Robert F. Kennedy Jr. become HHS secretary? You're clearly not really. There's not a mystery there, right? It's the politics of it. Trump wanted those voters. But, you know, if we ever get back, if we live long enough to get back to government being run responsibly and, you know, not merely viewing everything through a political lens, it has to be a priority to restore faith in not just government at large, that may be too heavy a lift, but critical institutions like the CDC. So would I have named RFK Jr. as my HHS secretary? Obviously not. And let's hope that, you know, if we have to live through these chronic crises, that what was the phrase you used? A tumultuous, what you're calling a tumultuous month, I'm calling a tumultuous several years. Let's hope that future adult administrations view it as a priority to restore faith in public health.
There's been a decline in confidence in institutions that have gone back a generation.
Of course.
It includes banks, schools,
news media,
churches, school media, everything that we used to have great confidence in. It has little to do with one incident and one spate of handling COVID. I think it has something to do with the fact that, for example, the church has had a problem with handling sexual abuse allegations. The banks, you know, collapsed on us. And so over time, America they've lost their faith in institutions. So whether or not you can pin this on COVID and at the CDC is not the case. And I think the diminishment of faith in the CDC was in part ramped up by far-right conspiracy theories, which made people think that there's a connection between autism and vaccines, for example, or that Big Pharma was out to poison us all. I think that is far more a complex situation than to just say, you know, the CDC was wrong, so wrong. What the government did when it came to dealing with COVID was wrong, and this is why America is justifiably putting its faith in Robert Kennedy going forward to help us deal with health crises.
So then I look, and you said this, so now I believe I'm using your term correctly, but you said now Robert F. Kennedy will put in one of his lackeys. Mm-hmm. I believe you said that. And I don't disagree with that. But one wonders why.
And we voted for that.
And one wonders why he didn't do that the last time.
Yeah, where was the lackey a month ago?
Right, exactly. But which is to your point of maybe the disconnect between Kennedy and Trump on those particular issues. But again, as of August 28th, 2025, where do we go when four of the top people that are running arguably one of the most important departments in our country is those positions are vacant? Let's take a break. We'll continue. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. This morning we are talking about the CDC director who I think was fired, but now she's refusing to resign. As to who actually has that job right now, I think she's out, but I'm not sure. It's being questioned, and there's been back and forth over the last 12 hours. So, but it's safe to say that it is a kerfuffle. We have Ira Fussfeld, Judy Patrick, Robert Pendicio with us to talk about it. We also welcome your letters, panel@WAMC.org. And yes, we have a few letters. Rocky says, there is no proof whatsoever that COVID initiated at a medical lab. In fact, the opinion of most reputable studies indicates that it is more likely to have occurred at the market. Then we go to Roger in Utica, who says, Judy Patrick's analysis that guidelines will mean insurance or government will not cover vaccines unless firmly recommended by CDC means that many low-income folks would choose not to receive vaccines largely due to the excessive cost. While Kennedy may be correct on overly processed food, sugars, and fats leading to increased obesity, his absolute nonsense of rejecting science on vaccines and infectious diseases makes his credibility near zero. Wait until we have increasing epidemics of influenza, COVID, measles, etc., and other diseases we had largely eradicated. That from Roger. Then we check in with Liz in Kingston. Hi, panel. I disagree that the CDC was politicized during the COVID pandemic. Scientists did not understand the virus for months. Early on, it was thought to be transmitted by touch. Remember having to wipe all the surfaces? Months later, it was correctly determined that it was transmitted by respiration. The American public does not understand that scientific inquiry is a process. I do believe that it was ignorance that caused distrust. As for the vaccine, it was a massive success, but again, ignorance trumped reason. Then we say, when referring to the CDC, the director, please call her by her name or her title, or say that doctor. Okay. What were we saying? I don't know. Okay. We said woman. Okay. Got it. Simply put, who thought it was a good idea to put a lawyer in charge of a Department of Science and Medicine? Just saying. That was from Jerome. And I think we have one. I thought we had one more here on my screen in front of me. I would like to get a little more accuracy in the language used around COVID policies and why all the skepticism exists. This from Dan. First off, there was very limited mandatory policies. We weren't prohibited from gathering. It was recommended not to gather in large groups. Two, we weren't mandated to have the vaccine en masse. Rather, certain situations required vaccination, such as healthcare workers. The very fact that you all are using this misinformation language is why we have all the skepticism in the first place. It was propaganda. It worked, even amongst those proponents of the vaccine.
Can I register a disagreement? I literally live two houses away from a gentleman who lost his house and had to sell it and move because he did not want to get the COVID vaccine and he lost his job. That's not imaginary. That's real.
And then we have this letter from Edward. Do you think having a right-wing mouthpiece spewing long-debunked misinformation about COVID and cult talking points will MAGA cult talking points will help you get your funding back or something? There is no other side or balance to the rise of a police state based on lies. That from Edward. All right, got it. And there is no definitive conclusion for how COVID-19 started, and to suggest otherwise is nonsensical and non-factual. Stick to the facts, says Lisa. So that's where we are in the letters.
I told
this
us
morning.
We shouldn't talk about COVID.
You did, actually. You did. Well, you said we were going to open up a whole thing there.
Well, as the writer from Utica points out, we're going to find out, sadly, how effective the COVID vaccine is when people don't get it because they can't afford it. They don't fit into the age classification or the pre-existing conditions classification. So there are bound to be millions of Americans who are not going to get the COVID vaccine, and we'll see what happens, because sadly, it's, from what we know so far, it's inevitable that the COVID will come back, if not as to the state it was at the beginning, mm-hmm. but it will come back. And then what? And is Kennedy going to say, well, I made a mistake?
Yeah. I think the one of the letter writers makes an excellent point about how and grace needs to be shown towards public health officials in the early days of COVID. Sorry, Judy, I'm going back there. In terms,
at your own peril.
Yeah, touche. In terms of, like, it's a developing thing. We may not have all the facts. Here's our best judgment. My point, however, about the summer of George Floyd was an example of the CDC or public health officials ignoring their own guidance for what most of us perceive to be a political purpose.
See, I don't recall anybody. This whole thing about you can't do a backyard barbecue, but you can go to a George Floyd protest. I didn't see that.
Goodness. I'll find the citation for you. But yes, that was a thing.
I'm going to follow Judy's advice and just not go there.
Cowards, both of you.
Yeah.
I think we should do what Trump said we should do very early on, which is to drink some bleach.
Yeah, well, and there was a lot of misinformation and there was a lot of confusion. And I think some of it was expected. We had never gone through anything like that before. And I think, as an earlier letter writer put, it's a process, and you have to go through it to figure everything out. And hindsight's 20/20, and you look back and you think, oh, okay, this isn't maybe this isn't what we should have done. David writes to us from Virginia. He's originally from Western Massachusetts. Along with 210 of my colleagues at the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, I was terminated without clear justification by the Department of Energy. We were later reinstated, only to be subsequently subjected to a reduction in force. I brought over 20 years of experience to my role and had the privilege of working alongside many dedicated physicians and professionals, most of whom are no longer with the agency. HHS has lost a significant number of highly skilled and committed individuals who served our country with integrity and dedication. Unfortunately, the department now operates as a shadow of its former self. And that is from David.
That's one of the things we're talking about on a state basis, of whether or not what states can mandate in terms of vaccinations and for kids entering school. We're seeing cases like that in the South now, where people are pushing for religious exemptions to be from vaccine mandates, and whether or not the states can say, no, only medical reasons can be a reason not to get vaccinated in order to enter the school system. I mean, one of the reasons we want everybody in a school system to be vaccinated is so, you know, this herd immunity, so we don't get these outbreaks of diseases like measles. So I think that will be something to watch going forward, state by state, as the states push to be able to change their rules regarding vaccine mandates for kids entering the school system.
Since I was challenged publicly, I feel the need to respond to this
on guard.
This idea that I may have made up the public health guidance about George
Nobody
Floyd.
Nobody suggested you made it up.
I didn't know. I had never heard that.
Well, then I'm happy to bring this to light. This is an article I just found on from Politico, not exactly, you know, MAGA Central. From June of 2020, the headline is, "Suddenly public health officials say social justice matters more than social distance." And it was all about that phenomenon.
Not a good headline, huh?
Too long.
Yeah.
Okay. But
too opinionated,
it's Politico.
But is that, I'm sorry, I don't want to prolong this.
But go ahead, Joe.
But let's do it anyway.
I don't want to prolong any of this, but I keep on having a 2-hour show to fill. And
put that bumper music back on.
What other choice do I have but to prolong it? Read that again. Do you have it in front of you? Read that again.
Or the first graph, maybe.
The nut graph. For months, public health experts have urged Americans to take every precaution to stop the spread of COVID-19, stay at home, steer clear of friends and extended family, and absolutely avoid large gatherings. Now some of those experts are broadcasting a new message. It's time to get out of the house and join the mass protest against racism.
But I want to know who some of the experts are.
Yeah, who were they?
What I remember of that time and was that there were people who said you would have to make the choice. Because I vividly remember, and I don't even know if you can say his name on the radio anymore, but Anthony Fauci and others saying, Deborah Burke, other people saying, you should be very careful going into group settings, regardless of your political convictions or your concern over social justice. However, if you did, you would go through these particular procedures. So I think there was a mix there. I don't know that it was, let's say, those who were very pro-vaccine were saying, well, vaccines be damned, this is more important to go out and...
Well, no, of course not. Nobody's ever that, you know, bald or naked in their public statements. It's just these are competing priorities, right?
But okay, when it makes it difficult to argue it on the radio.
Oh, man. Oh, okay. Fair enough. By the way, one of the folks quoted in this Politico article from 5 years ago, interestingly enough, was the former Centers for Disease Control and Prevention director Tom Friedman, who I'm paraphrasing from Politico here, who loudly warned against efforts to rush reopening but is now supportive of mass protests.
And wasn't the other part of that, and again, not to prolong this, but wasn't
we're gonna make
also,
Judy crazy here.
But wasn't also
this
but wasn't
is chaos,
that also
Judy.
because it was outside. right?
Right. And I mean, we were getting people. You could find a health expert to say almost anything.
We were filling playgrounds with sand and closing them too. Remember that this is one of the things that's dogged Gavin Newsom out in California, closing the beaches, etc. So. Again, I don't want to belabor this point any more than Judy wants me to, but the bottom line is surely we can recognize the politicization of public health, right? That's a problem. Can we all agree that that's a problem, and can we all agree that we should not do that?
Yes. I got a letter that said that I am, Joe, stop censoring the email. I don't know that I have censored any email, but I don't know what email you're referring to.
The one you didn't read, apparently.
I will. It's all in caps.
It's from Donald Trump.
It looks angry, but I don't know. This is supposed to be a democracy where energetic debate leads to consensus. Your censorship is the opposite of the process needed to arrive at consensus.
Wow.
All right. So I just want to get both. So for you, Robert, and for you, Judy, the answer to all of this is that it's my fault. We'll take a break. We'll figure this out some more. First news from Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, 9 minutes past 10 o'clock. On this 28th day of August. Joining us for the discussion this morning, Ira Fussfeld, publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman, former vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, and Robert Pendicio, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. And we welcome your letters, panel at wamc.org, panel at wamc.org. I do want to just mention there, I don't think there is a lot to say here other than to talk about it. We brought it up on yesterday's program as it was unfolding, and that is that two children were killed, 17 people injured at a Minneapolis Catholic school. This happened yesterday morning. The children filed into the pews of the Annunciation Catholic Church on Wednesday morning for their first Mass of the new school year. Just minutes into the service, as the students were reciting Psalm 139, a call and answer prayer about God's all-knowing love, the sound of gunfire ripped through the air and the church windows shattered. In an instant, the back-to-school glee dissolved into terror and chaos. The shooter was killed a short time later after this. That shooter, the assailant, later identified as 23-year-old Robin Westman, had stood outside the brown brick church on the city's southwest side and aimed a rifle through the glass at the young worshipers within. The shooter again killed two children ages 8 and 10, injured 14 more before dying of a self-inflicted gunshot wound in the parking lot. Three elderly parishioners were also wounded. The attack took place steps away from the church's affiliated school, which enrolls students from preschool through eighth grade. It was the nation's first school shooting since the end of summer break, expanding the list of communities to suffer from a uniquely American epidemic just 3 days into the Annunciation's fall semester. Parents, priests, and local leaders struggled to articulate the anguish they felt from such violence, piercing a place they held sacred, a place that as a school and a church they saw as a refuge. For Minneapolis, the pain echoed the trauma felt only 2 months ago when a gunman targeted two state lawmakers in their homes, killing Representative Melissa Hortman and her husband and injuring a colleague and his wife. The shooting began about 8:30 after Westman approached the house of worship armed with a rifle plus a shotgun and a pistol. Within seconds, as bullets sprayed, teachers ducked their students behind the sanctuary's wooden pews, shielding them from fire. Robert?
Well, I'm not comfortable talking about this. I'll be honest with you, Joe. For any number of reasons. One, you know, I'm an educator, so I work in schools. I work with children, so this kind of thing hits home. Two, I just despair of having a fruitful conversation about it. You know, in other words, whenever something like this happens, and I don't advise anybody to do this, if you look at social media, the instant reaction is, you know, whose team is going to take advantage of this? You know, who's to blame for this? What narrative does this support that I support? Look, the kids are not all right, okay? That's the bottom line here. We have a mental health crisis in this country. It is getting worse, not better. You know, you want to talk about guns, we can talk about guns. I want to talk about mental health. It is beyond contradiction at this point to say anything other than we have a real crisis with young people who are disconnected, who are acting out their grudges fatally. And if we're going to have a conversation about events like this, let us please try to make those conversations productive and helpful, and not turn them into the usual parade of confirmation bias and finger pointing.
Yeah, I'm going to go with my original reaction to this, which is I'm just angry. I mean, why this keeps happening? We're not doing anything about it. You know, you pass red flag laws. Well, Minnesota has a red flag law. That didn't help. We need to do something constructive to address this. I mean, I thought Sandy Hook would have been, you know, the case. But, you know, kindergartners shot. Now we have kids in pews praying, shot from outside. It's not like you could have hardened that church because this person was shooting from the outside. We need to do something. And it's not, you know, there are a lot of people with mental health problems that don't shoot up, you know, churches, kids, churches full of, you know, 80-year-olds and, you know, kids that are K through 8, I think it was. This is, and it's more than they, you know, let's talk about, you know, two children were killed, 14 others were injured. I mean, we just talk in terms of fatalities. Let's talk about the injuries children sustain, both physical and mental, when they go through something like this. The whole community is suffering and going through a trauma. You know, is it worth it to us as a society to be this violent, to allow this level of chaos happen? I mean, there is no excuse for this. Let's be angry about this and let the anger let us move to a constructive solution.
Yeah, you know, Joe, as I'm driving up this morning, when I, as I typically do when I come on the program, I try to, in the hour that I'm in the car, I go over in my head some of the topics that Joe has proposed we're going to be talking about, and I want to come up with something clever or different or unique or incisive. And I just find
you workshop your material.
Yeah, I workshop. I talk to myself. Nobody argues with me, but. It just every time I've been on the day after one of these things happened, and there have been at least several, and they happened many more times when I'm not around, the rhetoric that is well-meaning and thoughtful from all of the people who we interact with is the same, whether it's guns, whether it's mental health. I don't know at what point in time we should be raising the white flag. You wonder if it's ever going to change. We certainly can hope. The guns issue in this particular case, as far as I know from what I read, the guns were purchased legally. So then that checked that box off. Then the question is mental health. And by definition, if somebody is going to take a gun and shoot into a church, they've got to be mentally ill. Although we've had arguments from readers or listeners who've written in from time to time, don't like to make the connection if you say something like, "Oh, those people are crazy." Well, crazy is not the word you're supposed to use. So the only thing that I was I was struck by the passionate comments of the mayor of Minneapolis, who said what I hope many others would say was, and I'm paraphrasing, "I don't want to hear about your thoughts and prayers. These kids were in church praying." and still it happened to what happened. So that drive up where I was going to find something incisive to say, it didn't work. But
well, and I mean, I would disagree with you on that. I think it did work. But the mayor also took the opportunity. Robert, you mentioned this, that, you know, it seems that most of these things people just wait for a little information, and once they have it, the various camps seize on that information, and then it's manipulated into the story. In this particular case, it became that that Westman, who was the attacker here, was born Robert, changed their name to Robin and identified as female and wanted her name to reflect that identification. So quickly, some conservative activists seized on the shooter's gender identity to portray transgender people as violent or mentally ill. The mayor took exception to that immediately, saying that the trans community should not be villainized for this particular attack and the actions of this particular person. So once again, it becomes complicated by the facts and by what we know. But regardless, you leave a city fairly traumatized.
Right, and I think the media and the city officials involved handled the trans issue responsibly. They, in fact, I had to search. I heard the reference to the trans criticism. I had to search online to find this, you know, conservative criticism and allegations that it had something to do with this person transitioning. You know, the bottom line is there's really no the motive. There's no, you know, this person was mad at the world. They were mad at, you know, they were just spewing hate. We always try to struggle to find a reason. If we figure, if we think if we can find the reason this happened, that, you know, maybe we can prevent this from happening going forward. I think we have made some progress as a society in helping people identify people who might do this and try to get to intervene. There's some progress being made about that since, well, we've been dealing with this forever, but especially since Columbine. So I think that we as a society are doing better in terms of at least identifying it. Hey, and the one thing is during COVID, we didn't have any school shootings.
Didn't have any what?
School shootings.
Because nobody was in school.
Nobody was in school. It was one good thing.
But you know, and the other thing that struck me, and these are one of these things that you read, and I don't know enough about it. Like, I try to find enough as to how this works, but the FBI announced that they were investigating the crime as an anti-Catholic hate crime.
I think that's because there is a manifesto that this person left behind,
right.
And it was, I saw it, I didn't read it.
It was taken
off of YouTube almost instantly, but, you know, for good or for ill, you can find it if you're looking for it. And also there were any number of angry and, frankly, incoherent messages scrawled on the weapons and
the
cartridges
themselves.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, that's I don't know how seriously to take that. I'm not a mental health expert, but I think that's the source of that, Joe.
Yeah, anti-Semitic writings on the gun as well, mm-hmm. and a fascination with past serial killer,
that's right.
Mass shooting
assailants. Yeah.
So, but is that Christian or is that anti-Catholic?
I didn't see any anti-Christian things on the gun.
I didn't make an exhaustive study.
We have hundreds of millions of people in this country. And you've got yesterday a shooting at a Catholic school. You've got the black church. Was it in Charlottesville where the church was? Well, at any rate, there was a shooting in a church. There was a shooting famously in the synagogue in Pittsburgh. there's the pattern is not necessarily which religion. The pattern is that somebody was mentally ill enough to to get guns and shoot people.
I think that's right,
And with that many millions of people, again, I don't want to wave the white flag, but it's hard not to be demoralized and say it's never going to be changed. So just watch your back.
Well, I also, I mean, if I can amplify or add on to your point, Ira, I think it's dangerous work to try to add coherence to mental illness.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
So, which is why those messages tend not to interest me that much.
Exactly. Because you're reading into something of someone who is mentally ill, and that's.
Yeah, and in the previous segment, I was lamenting the politicization of public health. I'll double down on that here. The politicization of violence, I have no patience for it.
But what we need at this point is leadership. I think this is a problem. We can't just wave the white flag. We need to address this problem because our children are still going to school. People are still going to the movies. They're going they're going to concerts. I mean, this is not something we can just give up on.
Well, I'll also put in a plug for parenting as well. I mean, you know, red flag laws, I think, are a good idea. It seems inconceivable to me that someone didn't see something. You know, it's especially those of us who work with children. I was a teacher for quite a while. It's not a mystery when a kid is struggling. They have a hard time hiding it. So it seems, and again, I don't want to point fingers, but it seems unlikely that a person can be in this level of distress, you know, and say what you will about the transgender issue and gender dysphoria. Clearly, this is a person who has had attention for struggles over the years. So it seems inconceivable to me that you could have this level of anguish in your life and no responsible adult sees it and raises a red flag.
I will note as investigators search for a motive, the mother of Westman
worked in the church.
Worked as a secretary of the church until 2021. But in one of those writings said that maybe I could attack an event at the on-site church. And I do agree with Robert that looking at that material is the manifesto and such, while you think it may give you an insight, is just loudly disturbing. And
the insight I want is, why didn't anyone see this? Why didn't anyone know this? Why didn't anyone say something?
Right, especially when it is broadcast in some way, shape, or form on other on social media.
It's
going out into the world to someone, however limited that audience is.
You know, there's some discussion in the media about how we cover these. I mean, one of the things we do is we try to not to put too much focus on the assailant because we don't want to glorify and because
Don't mention their name.
Don't mention, you know. But also, the other thing we do is we downplay the horrific violence involved. I mean, we saw this yesterday where, you know, the people who were involved didn't really want to get into great detail about how horrific it is when a little kid gets shot. And maybe if we did see some of that or did hear more of these details, maybe we would be a little bit more angry and take a little bit more constructive action to address this problem. I think it's not that we're sugarcoating it, but we're not giving the American public a true picture of just how bloody, how horrific, how heartbreakingly horrible these shootings can be. So, and by doing that, by covering up and not being blunt about it, we are letting the problem continue.
Yeah, I'm not sure that anger is, with respect, I respect your anger, which obviously is earnest, Judy. This drains me of anger, and I think my impulse does not go to anger, it goes to empathy. There are people out there who are struggling, especially children. We need to be aware, and we need to be involved with them.
Well, I agree, too. We lose empathy. They become villainized, and instead of having the empathy of what got them into that condition in the first place. I'll just tell a quick story, and I don't know if it's worthy, but I think it was something that happened to me that I thought, oh, okay, I didn't understand this to this level. But my niece is attending a very large university, and she contacted us over the weekend and said that there was an active shooter on campus. Now, I know Villanova, Penn, and other universities had similar events, and they all turned out to be nothing. They all turned out to not be correct. However, as I was talking to her, she immediately contacted us, told us that she was safe. She was following the rules that the college and university had put into place, and that she was barricaded at her apartment. Okay, so then a little while later, the all clear is given, and the next morning I'm having a conversation with her, and she is very upset, very very upset, and just ready to pack up her belongings and come home. And the thing that I couldn't get through my little Joe brain was why this false untrue thing was having such an impact, was having such an effect. And I said to her, I understand you being upset, but it wasn't real. You know, it was like the monster in the closet. Mm. It wasn't real. And I don't know where you would go where you wouldn't have that perhaps monster in the closet. And then she played for me the videos that were taken by her and her classmates in the buildings within the campus where officers with guns are screaming, "Down, down, you're going to get shot, you're going to get shot, take cover, take cover, take cover." That's traumatic.
Yeah.
I mean, that is traumatic. And I don't know, I know we're doing the best to educate our kids on how to deal with these situations to limit the violence, but by the same token, the mental anguish that takes over a situation that did not happen, and I'm certainly not, I'm not pointing a finger at anyone saying that they shouldn't have done that. It was, they were acting on the information they had, but my goodness, it was deeply, deeply troubling. And I understand my niece's reaction to it. We'll pause on that. We'll take a quick break and come back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our program this morning. I thank you very much for being with us. We have about 20 minutes left to go over the remaining topics of the day. Before we do, I do want to get to some of the letters that we had regarding the shooting in Minnesota.
Don't censor them.
I will not. Okay. I will not censor, I promise. And just so people know, our letters are what I would call screened / triaged in the sense that sometimes their letters are incomplete. Sometimes they make a point that has already been made. Sometimes they're not clear as to exactly. I'm very mad about what you're talking about right now, and we don't really know at what point they wrote the letter, so we don't know what exactly they're talking about. And then also some are just, you know, a little wacky. So for the most part, as far as comments go and content, we don't censor that. If you hate us, we will gladly tell you that other people hate us.
It's not censoring. It's editing.
Yes.
Newspapers.
Well, I think 60 Minutes got in trouble for that, didn't they?
I don't remember, but I know.
Who
news,
did?
News, 60 Minutes with
oh,
the.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Newspapers don't print every letter that they receive. Censoring them? No, we're editing.
No, and I think regular listeners to the show know that we include letters that are positive. We include letters that are negative, and what we try to do, the main goal is that we try to give a fair representation of the letters that we're getting at any given time. So with that, we go to Allison in Arlington, Virginia. Why is no one asking about the guns? Why are we selling high-powered assault rifles to anyone? Maybe if we at least took away the most violent tools, we'd reduce the trauma. Obviously, we are not going to catch every mental health issue ahead of time or eradicate anger in the human experience, but we could do a better job of controlling the weapons. Face that fact.
Correct me if I'm wrong. There was no automatic weapon in this particular incident. Right?
I thought I read three handguns.
And automatic?
I thought it was a shotgun and a handgun.
No, a rifle.
But one of these semi-automatics, I believe.
My understanding is it was an AK-47, a shotgun, and a pistol. Okay.
And I only thought that because of where the writing I saw where that's where the writing was. Now, whether it was used and employed or found separately, I don't know the answer to that.
You know, it's great irony that the people who believe such a great need because of the Second Amendment to protect themselves from federal tyranny are now allowing the federal government to come into their police departments at the state level and with federal armed forces. It's just like a contradiction of an enormous proportion. I mean, we as a country need to have a real discussion about the Second Amendment. I live in a hunting area. But the idea that you have to have a semi-automatic gun because you like to go to the shooting range and shoot targets. We need to balance that. I think that needs to come up at some point.
All right, let's go to another letter. This one from Michael. The usual response to mass shootings like this is to post a patrol car or resource officer at these institutions. I wonder how the direction of the Department of Education towards vouchers will impact a school's or city's budgets if there is an increase in private schools needing to provide dedicated security. Oh, Robert.
I was not aware that was a Department of Education function.
Yes.
And in fact, I'm reasonably sure it's not.
We go to, thank you for fielding that, because I looked at it and I was like, I don't know. Sue is from Glenville. Republicans always talk about gun violence being due to mental health issues, which I agree with. But are they doing anything about the mental health issues? Cuts to Medicaid are going to make things worse. Most private insurances hardly cover mental health. And that is absolutely true. And a point that Robert made earlier about trying to, see the warning signs and what can you do and what is feasible, what is possible in seeing those problems through and getting help for the child in need. We go to Thomas, who says, good morning, panel. Uncoupling these mass shooting tragedies from a long overdue discussion about our nation's mental health is, I think, the main reason why these events keep happening. Granted, the pathology of mass shootings is complex, but one side seems to keep trying to focus all of this on guns, 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 which leaves the roaring fire of our national mental illness crisis burning out of control. Specifically to some of Judy's points, yes, there are lots of people with mental health issues who do not shoot people, but there aren't a lot of shooters out there who don't have mental health issues. I agree that there weren't a lot of school shootings during COVID, but you can't possibly be thinking that blanket school closure is a solution. Well, that certainly was not your point.
It was being too glib, I admit.
Yes. All right. We go to, Gregory, who says, it seems this person wanted to attack the church, his mother, and the world at large. The internet provides countless opportunities to find your corner of hate. As far as being a trans person, it seems, I'll actually leave that. So,
I should mention that I think it's either the CDC website or the Department of Justice website. There are places on those websites where you can get information about the warning signs that someone needs mental health and what to do about it. So I think the government does have some resources available. You just need to search them out. Even if you're thinking about, doing harm to yourself or someone or you think you know someone who might be doing that, there are resources available to give you that kind of guidance.
Jay says, I keep wondering, what do other countries that are like the U.S. doing that keep these things from happening in those countries? And that's long been a question and something that has been analyzed.
Although it seems to me in the recent couple of years that is not the case anymore. There have been shootings in Europe, and maybe it's one of our exports. I'm not sure, but it used to be the case that there seemed to be no shootings elsewhere, but no longer.
Let's go. Great point. Let's go to other topics on this morning as we start to wrap up our conversation with our panelists and with our audience. I do want to talk about ICE going to Chicago. The ICE is asking for access to Chicago area Navy base to assist operations. The request followed Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem's declaration that a strike team of immigration enforcement agents would arrive in Chicago soon. The Trump administration wants to use a Navy base north of Chicago as a launch pad for federal law enforcement activity against undocumented immigration, defense officials said yesterday, as the White House contemplates also deploying thousands of U.S. troops to the nation's third largest city. Amid rising tension with the Illinois governor, officials at Naval Station Great Lakes on Wednesday acknowledged having received a request from the Department of Homeland Security that seeks, quote, limited support for immigration and customs enforcement, whose aggressive tactics under the current administration have drawn outrage from opponents of President Donald Trump. The base, a hub for recruit training, would provide facilities, infrastructure, and other logistical needs. If the request is granted, defense officials said that in a statement. No decisions to approve access have been made. Officials said that responsibility lies with Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, who since taking office in January has eagerly pledged the Pentagon's full operation as DHS and its agents search for, detain, and remove undocumented immigrants. He has approved the use of other military bases to build detention facilities for people in DHS custody. So meanwhile, the request for all of this is also starting up the concerns within Chicago and with the governor of the city, of the state, saying with Governor or J.B. Pritzker, Democrat, has said that while Chicago has some challenges, there are no circumstances that warrant the deployment of military force there. Pritzker told reporters yesterday that no one from the White House or elsewhere in the federal government had contacted him about any such matters. They don't seem to want to communicate at all, and that's odd because it sounds like what they're trying to do is march right over local police, Pritzker said of the Trump administration. You know, you used to hear that the president of the United States supported local police. We support local police, but now it appears that he wants to ignore them altogether and just do whatever he has a whim about on any given day. That from the reporting of the Washington Post.
You know, this is the opportunity, the time for local news media to shine. I mean, to document what's happening so people know. I mean, we're hearing stories about home health aides being taken out of, you know, nursing homes, you know, because they're undocumented workers, of dairy farm employees, of, you know, all over our region and in places like Chicago. The question is, do we really want the federal military people being our protection, our level of protection? Do I want to walk down the street and see people with, you know, with assault rifles guarding me? I don't. I don't want to live in what essentially would be a police state. You have people being apprehended by people wearing masks. They don't even identify themselves, being taken away. What happens to them? I mean, we're not doing enough in our country to slow this down, because Stephen Miller wants 3,000 apprehensions a day. I mean, are we just trying to rid our country of everyone who's not white? Sometimes it feels that way. Pritzker's doing a fairly good job of speaking up for his state, but there's only so much he can do. I think the country as a whole has to speak up and say, this isn't right. We are a nation of laws. We are a nation where we believe in the legal process and due process and bring take our country back, especially at the local level. You would think Republicans who are such fans of federalism would support the notion that let local governments run their government and not intervene like this. It's a popular notion with his base, I understand. But even polling shows the base does not like this. The base believed that, you know, hardened criminals would be the ones that would be apprehended. I'd like to see some data on how many actually hardened criminals who were undocumented have been deported under this new regime.
I think they're making this up as they go along. During the campaign, when the whole talking point about immigration was center stage, and reporters were questioning, particularly Homan, is that his name, Tom Homan, who became the even more so than Miller, became the face of this whole effort. And people claimed they were going to round up millions of people, and they were questioned as to where are we going to put these millions of people. And they basically said, don't worry about it, we'll take care of it. And this is an extension of that. I think they now they're doing it, and they've got to figure out they need something in Chicago. How soon will they be looking for the old Brooklyn Navy Yard or wherever there's a facility? I'm not saying this is bad. This is good or bad. I'm just saying they're making it up as they go along. I don't think they have the answers to these questions even now.
Fan of research and data that I am, I would love to see some research. Judy, based on something you just said about, you know, feeling intimidated, or I'm not sure what your word was, about people with guns on the streets. I suspect that you're not alone in that, but I suspect there's an awful lot of folks who feel reassured by that. In other words, they don't necessarily view people in uniform with guns in full public view to be intimidating. They feel reassured, especially in places like airports and high crime areas and whatnot. So there's that. Look, on the immigration issue itself, obviously this is one of the things that got Trump elected. This was a very popular issue. It was an 80-20 issue. Every poll I've seen suggests some softening of that. Maybe it is because it's not, you know, exclusive to the hardened criminals, as it were, but it is, you know, affecting other sectors of the economy. In this particular story, Joe, I feel like I'm losing the thread here a little bit. In other words, is this just about ICE? Is this just about law enforcement? Because, you know, whether you admire Donald Trump or dislike him, it's amazing to me that we see this pattern over and over again, and Pritzker is the latest guy to fall into it. Trump is going to pick an issue that is going to embarrass a political opponent, and he's going to make them say something silly. So Pritzker had this tweet yesterday. I don't have it in front of me, so I can't recite it. But it was something about how, you know, 12 of the 20, you know, most crime-ridden cities are by Republicans or run by Republicans. Okay, so what are you saying then? That are you being blithe, Governor, about the levels of crime in Chicago? In other words, you're handing the president a political win by basically seeming blithe about crime in your city. And this happened in D.C., this happened in Los Angeles, and wouldn't it be interesting if one Democratic leader somewhere said, yeah, we appreciate the help, thanks very much, as opposed to, did you really want to make this argument about the federal overreach or whatnot? Do you really want to make this about that, or do you want to acknowledge that you've got a problem with crime in your city?
What's the end game?
In other words, I think it's just politics.
Yeah,
obviously.
But they bring these people into Washington, D.C., and immediately, within 10 days, which seems to me an awfully short amount of time to make a declarative victory, but the crime apparently has gone down in Washington as a result of these people being brought in. Does that mean they're now permanent in Washington, D.C.? Will there always be federal troops? Or will the National Guard at some point in time feel, okay, we've done all we can do here, we're going to leave, and won't be right back to where they started from?
Yeah, no idea what the political endgame is here.
Yeah, I just don't think they know what they're doing.
But my point is, I don't think it resonates with the average American to get into a debate about, is crime a problem? Oh, look at the data.
Right.
Last time I was on the roundtable, we were talking about this very instance in Washington, and I made the point, like, look, average people don't look at data. They look at the fact that I can't buy a tube of toothpaste at CVS because it's behind glass. You know, that's lived experience, as it were. So if you know, it amazes me, and look, I'm not a Democrat. I don't carry water for either party. But it amazes me that, you know, you know this is coming. You know this is going to be the narrative, and then you contribute to it.
Well, I think Democrats have learned that lesson. You're seeing that.
Tell Pritzker.
That not to deny that they have a crime problem, that they will say, yeah, crime is down, but it's. But it's still a problem. I've heard that from Los Angeles. I heard it in Washington, that, you know, any murder, any violent crime is down. Now the fact that things are behind the case at drugstores is a shoplifting problem. I'm not sure that that's a violent crime issue. It's a crime. It's certainly a crime issue. And to your point about people being intimidated by soldiers walking down the street with a gun, ask people of color if they're intimidated by that. I can assure you that they are, and I can assure you that I am.
No, I was just going to say we'll take a quick break and we'll be back and finish up right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. And we just have a few moments together. I interrupted you full anger rant.
It was about the idea that people may be intimidated by having militia on the street.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I'd love to see a poll on it, too. I'd like to see what Americans feel about that.
Aren't they saying that many of the National Guardsmen who were assigned to Washington, D.C. are landscaping, picking up trash, and just stuff that they didn't sign up for?
Yeah. In my interaction, which is limited, it always seems to me that the National Guard seems to act very professionally and very nicely, but they still have these huge guns in their hand, you know, and like you can't really get around that as far as they're very courteous. They're very helpful. I think they realize that this, you know, they're there and they're trying to welcome you and bring you into a city, into a subway station or whatever the case may be. So no fault to the men and women who are doing that job. But there does come this idea of seeing armed troops on the street that does give you a little pause as you're, and also those military vehicles when you see those parked in front of anything.
The most powerful force that in our lives, confirmation bias.
All right, we I'm pretending like I know what that means. Go ahead.
No, it's a Rorschach test. You see what you want to see. If you are intimidated by the sight of people in uniform and guns, you will feel intimidated. If you tend to be reassured by that and feel they're here to make me safe, you will feel reassured by that.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Finally, let us not forget the story about Lisa Cook, somebody else who got fired. And so now this is the term, the fate of the Fed may turn on two words, for cause. The Supreme Court has ruled that the Fed Reserve Board's independence warrants protection. President Trump's effort to fire a member will test that commitment. Whether it succeeds will turn on the meaning of a two-word phrase, for cause. In removing the leaders of other independent agencies, Mr. Trump has given no reason, saying he has the unilateral constitutional authority to control the executive branch, even in the face of congressional efforts to shield officials from political interference. The Supreme Court has lately sided with that view, rejecting statutes that have been on the books for decades requiring presidents to supply a reason for removing officials. But with the Fed, Mr. Trump has tried something new. This time, he explained in a letter to Ms. Cook on Monday, there was sufficient cause to remove her because of this, what he claims is mortgage fraud. And again, because of for cause, she is being removed, Ms. Cook responded that no cause exists under the law to allow for her removal.
Well, if she actually committed mortgage fraud, then she should go, okay? And she shouldn't have to be fired. She should resign, which is what we used to do when we were caught behaving badly as public officials. Look, Joe, for what it's worth, my interest in this story is more the context of for at least 20 years now, we've seen one president after another pushing the limits of expanding their authority. And this is another example of it. But also, I would argue that if you're offended by this, then you also you have more credibility if you were also offended when Obama said, I've got a phone and a pen, when Biden said, you know, ignored the court and waved away student debt, for example. So for those of us who have never been a fan of expanded presidential authority, this is yet another example. But why do I know that my fellow panelists are going to have a different view of that?
We have 30 seconds, so who would like to disagree in 30 seconds?
If you want to speak for me, go ahead.
No, I wouldn't dare.
I mean, the expansion of presidential authority has happened since Eisenhower. I think you have executive orders, but I think the Fed is truly something of a different order, and I agree with you that is the issue here. Is, you know, whether or not she committed fraud, I think that's for the lawsuit to resolve. This whole idea of whether or not we want an independent Fed is something we need
to resolve.
Trump
is going to be pushing on this and other issues. Mm-hmm. He's not afraid to go to court. He's lived his life in court, and he's going to try to get as much power as the limits will allow him to get.
Ira Fussfeld, Judy Patrick, and Robert Pendicio, I thank you all for being with us this morning. A lively conversation, as always. I wouldn't think of anything else from the three of you. We'll be back with more show right after this.